The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
It's so sad. We're not talking about numbers here. And that's what is people need to realize that.
What's up, Jimmy?
Hey, Justine.
So what are we hearing?
This is Ava Castillo, and she was at Concord City Hall last week with about another 50 people. They were at a rally, and they were hoping to pass a resolution affirming support for the immigrant community.
We're real people with, you know, that suffer, and we're separating not only the kids that are in cages, but the kids that are left behind from parents that are deported.
I think that people are really looking for an opportunity to express how outraged that they feel, and they want to take action. And it was hard.
Well, words have meaning. And when the Attorney General and the President and all their various agency heads use words such as describing immigrants as animals, as not differentiating between the fractional, tiny minority who are sources of problems and the rest who are essentially hardworking, industrious people who are just trying to provide for their families. That has an impact.
So and at this rally, people had signs and stickers that said, stop separating families. There were dozens and dozens of tiny little shoes and sandals representing abused migrant children in U.S. custody. And there were even like these little yard signs with migration stories. There was this focus also on how the zero tolerance policy is taking hold in New Hampshire with things like the Customs and Border Patrol checkpoints.
And people just need to realize what these checkpoints are. They're the government stopping and seizing individuals without any reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a crime's been committed. That's never been what this country's about. And we've seen increased use of these checkpoints, not at the border, but in the interior of New Hampshire.
What purpose do you think all of that serves? You know, is that a practical purpose? The checkpoints and the
I think it's to create fear and intimidation. I don't think there's any other purpose for it.
And people spoke very bluntly of the national rhetoric that's trickled down into our state.
You know, it doesn't take a rocket science to know that people are racists, a lot of racists, and I always felt it, but they did not feel empowered to talk about it.
What we're seeing is a lot of separating people into multiple classes, and that's really, I don't think, what this country is about. And when you start separating people into different classes, into different groups, it becomes so easy to dehumanize that other group.
It's always been dehumanizing, but now I have never seen so much meanness. It's hatred, it's pure hatred, and it's like their goal is to inflict as much pain as they can. It's hard not to feel personally affected by everything.
Like, what was the mood generally at this rally?
Mm. I mean, there's a lot there, but everyone I spoke with also talked about the hope that they feel, and especially with rallies like this one, the sense that both Concord and the state can affirm itself as a welcoming place that's encouraging to immigrants.
And it was heartening to see so many people come out and to, you know, a lot brought their own signs. People want to say, this is not okay, this is not who we are better than this.
It's amazing, like the June 30th, there were 11 rallies in New Hampshire. I've been living in New Hampshire for over 30 years. I had never seen rallies in so many places at the same time for immigration.
You're listening to Word of Mouth?
Your questions answered, your state explored.
So what ended up coming from that rally?
Well, this was originally organized by the Kent Street Coalition and the ACLU, the goal to influence the city council meeting that was happening to pass this resolution to make the state a more affirming place. And I just want to say thanks here to Rob Abramson, Gilles Bissonnette, Louise Spencer, and Ava Castillo for talking there.
So the resolution was to basically state that we're a welcoming place for immigrants?
Correct. And to kind of like push back on some of the policies that you're seeing now, like the checkpoints and things like that.
So given the diversity or kind of lack thereof in this state, we're a predominantly white state, it is interesting to think that this immigration debate is something that's also taking place on a state and local level here in New Hampshire.
It is, yeah. And not just with the checkpoints, but also the history and this pride that the state has with things like the refugee resettlement program.
Right, because we already do have a robust refugee resettlement program here. But just about how much of what is happening with the CBP checkpoints on the highway, how much is that is being influenced by national policy and rhetoric?
I mean, that's really tough to gauge, right? But I did think it was probably an appropriate spot for a montage.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
So the Supreme Court saying today the president does have the authority under immigration laws in this country to enact this travel ban.
Meanwhile, signs of growing extremism in this country on the left are everywhere.
The Statue of Liberty normally gets a lot of attention on the 4th of July, but not quite like this.
A Congolese immigrant shut down the Statue of Liberty, our Statue of Liberty.
A law enforcement official telling WNBC she planned to stay until all the children have been released.
The Associated Press reports some immigrant U.S. Army recruits who were promised U.S. citizenship are now being discharged. Some of those servicemen were told they've been labeled security risks because they had relatives abroad or had incomplete background checks.
And now the administration says it could be denaturalizing potentially a few thousand people.
The last time the federal government tried to denaturalize citizens was during the McCarthy period.
Well, another part of the anti-immigration marches is to abolish ICE. It's a growing call from Democrats.
Protesters calling for the abolition of ICE were blocking a few garage doors at the headquarters. And when officers demanded they move, the scuffle ensued.
We should protect families that need our help, and that is not what ICE is doing today, and that's why I believe you should get rid of it, start over, reimagine it, and build something that actually works.
Abolish ICE, this call to action has been around for a minute, but we're just starting to see it being parroted by elected officials. And we're joined now by NHPR demographic reporter Robert Garova.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Robert. So what do we actually know about ICE?
So ICE was created when there was sort of reorganization of immigration enforcement agencies. So when the Department of Homeland Security, the umbrella organization, was formed in 2013, ICE also became a part of that. So they're the arm that's tasked with interior enforcement. Right now, there's about 20,000 ICE personnel. When you talk about money, for fiscal year 2019, the Trump administration is trying to bump up their funding by about $1 billion, which would bring them in at about $9 billion.
And so you had a story that just aired, and this was following a family that was actually picked up by the agency.
Well, yeah, and it like reporting on immigration stuff is like very confusing because technically, they weren't picked up by ICE. They were picked up by Customs and Border Protection, by Customs and Border Patrol agents, which are under Customs and Border Protection. So they were picked up by Border Patrol agents on the I-93 in Woodstock, and then brought to a Stafford County Department of Corrections, which contracts with ICE. So then eventually they were held by ICE in Dover at a jail in Dover.
All right, this does sound confusing. So what should we know about CBP?
So CBP stands for Customs and Border Protection. They were also formed, when there was this Department of Homeland Security reorganization thing that happened. But what I think is more, what is interesting is that the Border Patrol, the U.S. Border Patrol, which is under Customs and Border Protection, was formed in 1924 at a time when there were more immigration concerns in the country because it was, between World War I and World War II, sort of that interwar period. They started out with less than 500 agents, and now we're up to about 20,000 agents nationally. So, I mean, you can see it really grow, since this thing that started in the 20s to what it is now.
Okay, can we hear the story?
Yeah.
It's Robert Garova.
Victoria is 23 and working her way through college. Over Memorial Day weekend, she and her parents piled into the car and drove from New York for a vacation in the north of New Hampshire. Hanging out at the hotel, taking a ride on the Cog Railway, that kind of thing.
I mean, it was just a nice getaway to, go with my parents because, when I'm older, I can't really spend time with them. And I also brought my dog, too, which, she's getting older and she likes being outside.
Victoria, her mom, dad, and pet Shih Tzu made it to the White Mountains without incident. But as they were going back home, they noticed traffic slowing down on the highway near Woodstock. Victoria says she initially thought it was officers checking for drugs. But then she saw signs for Department of Homeland Security on the side of the highway.
They made it so that, like, no one could actually, like, turn around.
Her parents, Mr. Park and Miss Lee, don't have legal immigration status after coming to the U.S. from South Korea. NHPR isn't using the family's full names because they fear it might affect their status in this country. When they reached the Border Patrol officer, Park and Lee declined to answer questions about their citizenship, and they were asked to pull over to the side. Victoria came to the U.S. when she was 4, she says, and is currently protected from deportation because she's a recipient of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. She told them that, but it didn't seem to matter.
They were kind of dismissing my DACA status, saying that, oh, like, that has nothing to do with your status. Like, it doesn't matter if you have a work permit or whatever. Like, you're coming with us.
Victoria's parents were arrested, but Victoria was let go and made the drive back to New York with her dog, alone.
I was just worried, like, what if they're going to hurt my parents? Or, you know, what if this is the last time I'm going to see them and I couldn't even say goodbye?
It kind of felt like she and her family were caught in a trap, Victoria says. She had no idea immigration officers could do this kind of thing.
Because, like, you know, that's something I would suspect if we were, like, down south, like, near the southern border, but, like, we didn't even think about the Canadian border.
Under a Department of Justice rule, the Border Patrol is allowed to conduct these checkpoints 100 miles from the border, and they have been since 1953. What's harder to know is whether or not these checkpoints are happening more frequently. CBP has repeatedly denied requests for an interview. In previous statements, they've called the stops a critical tool for the enforcement of the nation's immigration laws. CBP has also provided that checkpoints on the I-93 have taken place for, quote, several decades. After their arrest in the White Mountains, Victoria's parents, Park and Lee, were taken here, to the Stafford County Department of Corrections in Dover. The county has a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to provide up to 130 beds for detainees. The day I visited, 121 beds were occupied. Jail Superintendent Chris Brackett says ICE doesn't tell him how many of those detainees are coming from Border Patrol checkpoints, but one thing is clear.
Primarily, we have seen an increase in ICE population.
The average population for ICE detainees at the Dover jail was 79 in 2016. From January through May of this year, the average is up to 114, a more than 40% increase.
No hate, no fear. Immigrants are welcome here, no hate.
At a recent immigration protest a few miles away from the jail in front of Dover City Hall, speakers from local faith-based groups and the ACLU called out the Woodstock Border Patrol checkpoints as going against New Hampshire's values. Just last month, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy proposed legislation which would limit the border zone, where checkpoints are admissible, to 25 miles. Hannah Gurman is a U.S. historian at NYU. She points to a trend that she says has arisen since the founding of the Border Patrol in 1924, increasingly blurred boundaries between enforcement on the border and enforcement in the nation's interior.
Under the Trump regime, you see a vast increase in interior border enforcement.
So-called interior enforcement could come in the form of arrests on highways or even on buses.
The big change that happened under Trump, particularly in the first year, was deporting people who had been in the United States for a long time, living here with families, who had no criminal record whatsoever.
After their arrest in Woodstock, Park and Lee were eventually taken to federal offices in Burlington, Massachusetts. In the parking lot, immigration attorney Sang-Yob Kim and I discussed the couple's case. Kim got word they were being held in prison and offered to act as their pro bono attorney.
In this case, there were no criminal issue at all.
Kim submitted letters from their church and their daughter to convince a judge that they were not a danger if they were let out of jail. Park and Lee posted a total of $9,000 bail, and a judge agreed to their release. Some friends from New York drove here to pick them up. The dad, Park, is released first. He walks out of the building by himself, still in vacation attire, t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. It starts to rain, so we talk in the backseat of their friend's SUV. He describes being placed in shackles every time he was transported.
They tie and chain, and then we can't move anything, you know, like this.
After first going to the Dover jail with his wife, they were split up, and he went to an ICE detention facility in Massachusetts.
We can't see each other, you know, during 23 days. No.
What are you feeling right now? Is you're about to see your wife again?
I
Park begins to tear up when I ask him about this. But it's not long before he's smiling, as Lee is released from custody. Lee tells me she's worried she's lost her job back in New York. As far as what's next for this family, fighting deportation from home, weeks after they set out for a weekend getaway in the White Mountains.
So what's the next steps for this family? How is this going to move forward for them?
Well, they have a different lawyer now. The lawyer in the story, the guy's name is Sang-yeob Kim. They actually picked up a lawyer in New York so that they can fight their deportation case from home. So they are now embarking on hearings, you know, paperwork, and all the things that come with dealing with, you know, someone going through deportation.
What was the reaction to the story like?
The reaction to the story?
Ooh. Yeah, what was the reaction to your story?
There were a lot of comments on the NHPR website. You know, and at least the first comments were sort of geared around, you know, these are the laws of the nation. You know, some people said good, you know, Border Patrol, CBP is doing their job in enforcing the nation's laws. I think there's also a sentiment from other comments that I've read that this is kind of a weird thing to have happen in the live free or die state of New Hampshire, right? Because you imagine, especially if these checkpoints are happening over the summer on a route that a lot of people take to, like, go on vacation in the White Mountains, you imagine that a lot of people aren't necessarily expecting to go through a checkpoint like this, especially, you know, about 90 miles away from the Canadian border. So there were a good amount of people who sort of had that sentiment as well.
Thanks for sharing Victoria and her family's story. Are you going to be in touch with them going forward?
Yeah, I'm gonna try to as much as possible. They're back in New York now, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, I'll be curious. Thanks, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of political force behind right now strengthening the borders, but there is also an idea that maybe we could also take an alternative approach. We could take a completely different approach. This is kind of more of a imaginary or an abstract idea right now, but if what would a conversation about open borders look like on the other end?
Well, the main thing is that an enormous number of people would move from poor countries to richer countries. There, of course, the other kind of movement just within rich countries.
This is Brian Kaplan. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University and author of The Case Against Education.
The people most interested in moving are generally from poor countries. They would move, of course, because they know that they're going likely to get much better jobs. But the main thing that people overlook is when they do this, they are increasing the wealth of the world. They're moving their labor from countries where they don't produce very much to countries where they produce a lot. So it's not just a matter of helping the people move. It's a matter of enriching all mankind.
I asked him, with all of the migratory movement, to break down why mass migration could have such a strong economic impact.
I mean, you know, so the main thing to realize is just that labor is much more productive in some countries than others, and it's not mainly the workers. So, you know, the day that a Haitian shows up in Miami, he suddenly is producing 20 times as much value as he was back in Haiti. And, you know, that's the amazing thing, is that merely crossing borders turns the same individual into a much more productive person. And, of course, this wealth, you know, partly it makes the person who did the crossing better off, but it also enriches all of mankind. So, like, a thought experiment that I like to use is, imagine you had a million farmers stuck in Antarctica, so they're just eking out an existence farming the snow. You know, what happens if you let those farmers leave and go to, say, Argentina? I mean, obviously they're better off, but when they move to Argentina, they produce tons more food, and they're not going to eat it all themselves. Instead, most of that extra food they're going to sell to other people, so it winds up benefiting everybody who eats. So, you know, the slogan that I like is, you know, open borders is not trickle-down economics, it is Niagara Falls economics. Mm. It is going and taking hundreds of millions of people who are doing almost nothing for the world right now because they're stuck in the countries where it's hard to get much done, and you move them to places where they can realize their potential, which is good for them and good for the world.
Another example that I've seen where folks kind of, you know, the natural reaction is that this kind of movement would impact jobs. It would impact people's ability to work and make the money that they do now, at least in the more prosperous countries. And the example that really sticks with me is kind of, I think you had referenced it in the past, but like the 60s and 70s, as women started to enter the workforce more, it didn't result in mass unemployment of men.
Of course not. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, that's a great example because that's an enormous number of women enter the workforce during this period. So, you know, you might sit around and think, well, like all these women coming in, they're going to destroy the labor market for men. And it really doesn't seem like that happened. Instead, the main thing is all of this female talent that would have gone to waste becomes available for the benefit of people not only in this country but in the world. Right? So, I am an economist, and out of all of the lessons of economics, the one that I like to teach people first and foremost is this. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. Whenever you're thinking about any economic change, you should focus on the effect on production, because that's the fundamental thing that's happening.
So, Brian, I've got a question then. Can this actually happen?
Definitely can. Do I think it's likely? No, but moves in this direction are possible. You know, I'd say just the main thing is the idea of open borders provides a roadmap. It says this is where we're trying to get to, and it gives you a way of evaluating all of the moves in between. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be open borders overnight. I don't think it's going to happen in 10 years. But still, if you think that it's a good idea and would work well if tried, this colors all of your analysis of the discussions people are having. You know, not just things like, you know, how many immigrants should we let in, or should we keep out people from certain countries? You know, like also for me, it has a big effect on my view about border enforcement, where I look at that and say, well, you're trying to stop something that's good, so it'd be better to not enforce, right? Which, again, is, you know, of course, taking me far outside of regular American discourse, but, you know, of course, I have the luxury as a professor of just being able to speak my mind and not worry too much what people think.
That was Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University and author of the upcoming graphic novel titled Open Borders. This is Word of Mouth.
Your questions answered, your state explored.
And we're staying on script, talking about borders with the game that transcends them, the world's game.
Yes, people, we are talking about soccer, or football, if you want to be universal with it.
Right. In case you missed it, the Men's World Cup is wrapping up, or has wrapped up, which may have been easier to miss this year since the U.S. men's team failed to qualify for the tournament.
I feel like they're an internal disappointment.
The men's team.
The men's team. And you and I were talking about this earlier. I didn't grow up playing soccer, but I can pinpoint the exact moment I became a soccer fan, and that was the 1999 Women's World Cup.
Oh, my God, that moment.
The two very best teams in this World Cup going at it. And China's had the edge lately, not in the overall.
Well, I was 9 years old, and I think I had started to play soccer by that point. And I think I had actually gone into the yard, and I remember my parents were having a party. Everyone was sort of gathered around the TV, and I remember hearing the moment from inside, this roar. Like the whole room just erupted, and I ran inside in time to see Brandi Chastain just like falling to the ground with her hands in the air, and she whipped off her shirt, and I saw the whole women's team running across the field toward her, and I think that was just the moment that I was oh my God, soccer, it's my favorite sport.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that, well, one of the first times that you've seen professional soccer players who are women competing on the world stage and like in our country and inspiring not only young girls.
That was women's soccer star Morgan Andrews. Does that name sound familiar to you?
I can't say it does.
Well, Justine, Morgan was born and raised in Milford and just so happens to be the LeBron of New Hampshire in kind of that youth sports prodigy way.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, is it fair to call you the LeBron of New Hampshire soccer?
Well, as much as I appreciate that, I don't know. There are quite a few other amazing soccer players who I feel would deserve that same honor.
All right. Well, let me interrupt then and let me make the case for you as the LeBron of New Hampshire soccer, or maybe even past the LeBron. So you were back-to-back Gatorade Player of the Year. I think that's happened a handful of times, under 10 times in the history of the award. ESPN's top-rated player in the class of 2013. An All-State football player. Is that right, too?
Yeah, my junior year. I kicked for my high school football team my junior and senior year.
And you were also a state champ in soccer as well. So, I mean, that's my pitch.
Well, it's quite an honor. But to my brother's defense, I do have to say that they have made quite an impact on themselves. Matt is a Green Beret in the Army. And Mike is just recently won Boston Public School Teacher of the Year. So I'd say that they're making probably more of an impact than I am.
Okay. Maybe you're a little bit more modest than the king. So you're recently starting your pro career. I think you were playing like semi-pro ball as a teenager. But you're playing out and for the National Women's Soccer League in Seattle for the Seattle Reign. And I just wanted to hear a bit on what do you think people should know about both the league and then the players that you're competing with and against?
The league is composed of, I'm not kidding, the greatest soccer players in the world. Players coming internationally and those who are homegrown here in the United States. And first off, a complete honor to compete in this league. And second off, it honestly doesn't have the respect that it deserves, but our fan base is really loyal and we love our fans, but we're still trying to find every day a way to bring more people into our league and to help bring in the support that it deserves. But the league itself is competitive. Right now it is composed of 9 teams. There were 10 teams last year. I competed for the Boston Breakers, and unfortunately, right before the season started, our team had folded. So now we're back down to 9 teams and with hopefully an expansion in our future.
What is up? Why do men flop so much? And I feel like I don't see it in the women's game.
Yeah, that's a great question. I am not necessarily against selling a foul. There can be a strategy in game management to being able to draw a foul and specific parts of the field. However, I'm not a fan of flopping. Of course, there is a difference between the men's and women's games. And although sometimes a tackle might be harder against a male opponent, women aren't really seen as floppers in our game. But in the women's game, we're still fighting for the respect to be able to play the game, unfortunately. And I think that goes into the aggressiveness that is played, especially in the NWSL. We play with a lot of aggressiveness, and we're a forward-pushing league, and we attack a lot, and it's one of those things that we just don't do. When a foul is drawn, it's usually earned.
You have this incredible, I'm just going to take a look at this, and I want to read maybe one or two of these, but you have 8 separate tweets that kind of go on to highlight some of the disparities between equality in the men's to the women's game, both, you know, in sports in general. And I just want to start with the first one. I'm just curious because I found this one really, it's a good jump off point, but you say it's a push around the globe to make it known that better is not good enough. The theme sparks stories of empowerment, but also observance of inequalities. Hashtag athletes for progress.
Right.
And so can you get into that a little bit? And like, what is, you know, the difference between better and equal?
Well, you know, that tweet basically was sparked by the fact that women in sport, although people say it's so much better because, oh, hey, we're getting a paycheck every month, or we actually get to play the sport, that doesn't mean that we're equal. Some of us aren't even making minimum wage to start off with. While a lot of men who are in our same position are able to afford homes or cars even. Or
just work a single job.
Yeah, or work a single job, exactly. Have the luxury of being able to focus on their sport or what is considered their job, exactly. And so that's one of, I'd say that's one of the more frustrating things to hear is when people say, oh, you should be grateful for having things better than the women before you. Yes, that's absolutely a thing, but that doesn't mean that we should stop fighting for what's right and for equality and equity. And so for me personally,
you know, better is just not good enough, and that will be my answer until we have equal pay and equal respect. And that also means equal television time. Very little time is spent speaking about women in sports on television, and that's so important because for children to be watching television and only see men, then that's put into their minds that, you know, men are better at sports, or men are the only ones who are allowed to play a sport for a living. And that's just not the case.
That was New Hampshire soccer legend and Seattle Reign midfielder Morgan Andrews. If you've got a little World Cup hangover, you can follow the women's national team this October as they'll play to qualify for their next year's World Cup. You can also watch our very own Morgan Andrews play at nwslsoccer.com. All right, so there's a small contingency of World Cup diehards here at the station this summer. There's me, along with Jimmy.
Vamos, Mexico.
And also there's Daniela Vidal-Ali, who is our couch fellow, rooting for her native Colombia.
Until they got knocked out by England.
But how serious is this summer for you, this World Cup?
It is so serious for me and my family. I grew up watching every World Cup game from 2006, 2010, 14. We just sat in our living room, watched like 3 or 4 hours of soccer pretty much every day. Or we'd wake up super early to watch like a game that was happening in Japan where this Colombian team had won the South American version of Champions League. Anyway, so we woke up like 4 a.m. to watch these games. So it is deep in his blood.
Were there snacks involved?
No, I don't know. Maybe. Growing up in a Colombian household, that's something that is just an essential part of who you are and rooting for your national team and, you know, hearing so much pride when you hear the anthem. I always think, you know, we went to Nashua to go talk to Colombians watching the Colombia-England game. And something I was curious about is like, man, what does it feel like to watch your home country when you're not living there? And that made me think of my dad, and he's been here since 1982. So that's a lot of World Cups.
That is.
Colombia has not qualified for many of them. But, you know, I was curious what his experience was like from like 1990, 1994, when Colombia did qualify.
Lo que pasa después del Mundial, cuando matan a Andrés Escobar, ¿no? Por haber cometido un autogol, ya era un repudio total a la clase narcotraficante que manejaba el fútbol.
I had heard from my mom vaguely that my dad had been greatly changed by the killing of Andrés Escobar, this Colombian player who scored an own goal in the 94 World Cup, but I didn't realize to what extent. The man that I knew growing up loved soccer so much.
So what was he saying right there?
So he's saying that, you know, after the 94 World Cup, just a few weeks later, Andrés Escobar was killed. So his assassination led to this backlash of the narco class, like Pablo Escobar, who controlled Colombian soccer, really, the players, the refs, how things went, and, you know, for him, the game had just been stained by this innocent man's blood.
Doloroso porque Andrés Escobar era lo que tenía la selección para mostrar como gente típica colombiana, una persona humilde, sencillo, inteligente, muy, muy educado.
Here he's saying it was even more painful that it was Andrés Escobar who was killed, because he was, you know, this picture of all of the best Colombia has to offer, you know, humble, hardworking, intelligent, polite. You know, he was kind of like the face of the Colombian team. And so the fact that he was killed, you know, was like, how low has our country fallen then? How low has the sport fallen here?
Dijiste que te alejaste como de ver solo el fútbol colombiano. ¿Cuántos o meses o años te tomó?
And so, what did you just ask him?
I asked him how long it had took him to get back into soccer. And I thought it was just a few months, but it ends up it was years.
Viendo a 22 personas correr detrás de un balón. Y cuando no hay sentimiento, cuando no hay ese apego como fanático, es aburridor.
So for him, soccer became really boring afterwards. For him, it just lost
all this meaning and connection and feeling that he had before Andres Escobar was killed. So it was, to him, it just felt like 90 minutes, 22 men, and one ball that they're chasing after, and that's it.
And so at this point, in 1994, you have yet to hit the scene, right?
Yes. I don't think I was conceived July 1994 yet. I was born July 3rd, 1995.
So then what did you want to ask him? You know, because you have siblings, right?
I do, and we all grew up playing soccer. And like I mentioned earlier, soccer was just the way our family lived life. All three of us were on club teams, or at one point we were on two teams, and you had crazy weekends where it'd be like 12 games. I'm like, oh my gosh, how did my parents do that? So I always thought this is what he wanted for his kids. I always thought he wanted us to be huge soccer fans and good soccer players, and that I was curious. Did he?
Yo volví a prácticamente fue por Santiago, porque Santiago andaba jugando con una pelota y cuando estábamos construyendo la casa y el contratista hizo dos canchas en usando 2x4 y Santiago empezó a jugar ahí y luego ustedes se metieron.
So he says, you know, really it started out with my brother because my dad didn't have that much of a reference point for women playing soccer. You know, grew up in
weird
Colombia in the 60s. So, yeah, so we were doing some construction on our house and this contractor had made these goals with 2x4s and my little brother was playing out there and my sister and I joined him. And around the same time, we wanted to play on our school soccer team. So my dad was like, okay, this things are getting interesting. Like everyone is showing some kind of interest in getting involved.
Pero luego ya que empezamos a jugar fútbol, eso, el deporte parece que se volvió más como algo central de la familia y de lo que hacíamos y como.
So now it's becoming a central part of everything you do, or inseparable from anything you do.
Yeah. So that's what I asked him. Is, you know, now that we started playing, it seems like soccer was a way that we started to relate to each other or just became part of who our family was and what our identity was about as a unit.
Siendo hispanos, no creíamos en decir, si vean que papá las lleva ni nada. Entonces nosotros empezamos a ir, a asistir.
Wait, what did he just say right there?
He said, us being Hispanic, we didn't believe in other people taking you to soccer practice. So carpooling, not a thing in my family.
Okay.
Entonces, con tus hijos participando, eso como despertó más.
I asked him if with us playing soccer, if that participation brought up the feelings that he had had towards the sport before 1994, before Andrés Escobar's death. Mm.
Claro, porque como dije, el fútbol es una emoción, es un sentimiento, y los sentimientos se pueden enmascarar, pero no se pueden eliminar.
It's a beautiful man.
Yeah, he just said, you know, soccer is this feeling, this sentiment, and feelings can be masked, but they can't be eliminated, is what he just said.
And so we watched the England game together.
We did, yes.
And it was a very heartbreaking game. Colombia had a nice late run there.
We did, by Jerry Mina, yeah, the 93rd minute. He's from my home state of Cauca. So
all
let's,
right.
Let's go.
But I felt like I didn't get the full Daniela experience because, you know, one, you had a recorder and you were asking people what their experiences was, but also when you got on the phone at a certain point, you called your dad. I could tell that this is a bond that you two had, and mm-hmm. it felt sad watching you not to be able to share it in person.
Yeah. I'm kind of tearing up right now. yeah, it's like, my dad had called me, and I missed his call. And so I was like, clearly he wants to talk about the game. Mm. There's no other reason why he's calling me right now, as, you know, Colombia's in overtime versus England in the round of 16.
Pues hablamos de este mundial. Para ti, se sintió diferente que yo no estar en la casa viéndolo con ustedes.
And so is that what you're kind of asking him right there?
Yeah, I'm asking him if it felt different for him that I wasn't at home, because I know it felt different for me not to be at home.
Are you going to be able to talk about his answer and not cry?
I don't know.
Sí, mija, porque hay menos que compartir, hay menos que decir, viste eso, viste lo otro, ver las estadísticas,
comentar los partidos, ¿no? Entonces, se siente, es como ir a un estadio solo, ¿no? Entonces, es diferente ir en familia o ir un grupo que ir uno solo. Es diferente ir a una película uno solo y que ir un grupo, una familia.
So, I think I'm keeping it together.
You are. It's pretty impressive.
So, here he's saying, you know, for him, it's like there's just less to share after a game, or less of, did you see that? Did you see this? And, I mean, my dad's watching it with my mom and with my brother when he's not in class. But, like, you always need the other person to geek out about the same thing that you love. And if you're not there together, then it's like, who do I geek out about this with if there's nobody else in your life that you've kind of built that same relationship with? And so the way my dad describes it is like going to a stadium by yourself. You know, like you're not with your friends, you're not with your family. Sure, you can kind of get the emotions that strangers kind of give you if they're also wearing the same jerseys, but it's like not the same to like turn around to your dad or your friend and just be like, ah, like they just scored, you know? And so yeah, that's how it felt like to me too, sitting in my room and watching it by myself.
As just listening to your story, I think of all of the practices he took you and your brother and sister to. I think of all of the games that you had watched, every single World Cup, you know, not missing a game, waking up early, staying up late with what sounds like no snacks, which is inhumane. But, I mean, you have all of this history and it's, you don't just forget about that.
No, it feels like a new phase of life. I think that's actually, I got married last year, and I think this has been the biggest thing that's like shown me the difference in not being at home. Like, I'm usually pretty adaptable to moving to any places or anything. But like for the first time, it's like, oh wow, this is what it really means not to be home. And I haven't thought about it a lot, so have lots of feelings coming up all of a sudden.
It's clearly hitting you.
Yeah.
And what is home but a place filled with family and love?
Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Hannah.
So you are from Wisconsin.
I am from Milwaukee, which is a part of Wisconsin. So yes, I'm from Wisconsin.
Okay. So Wisconsin is the dairy capital of the world, right? That's my understanding.
Yes, it is. Okay. Cheese everywhere. Cows everywhere.
So all of like the cheese, the ice cream, it's because there are cows everywhere in Wisconsin, right?
Oh my God. We have so many cows. It's like, it's absurd. And this again, not within Milwaukee, but if you drive anywhere outside of Milwaukee, there's a very distinct prairie farm. It's a cow. You're smelling cows. So there's a distinct smell you cannot escape.
Lots of cows mean lots of milk, mean lots of people who eat ice cream like it's going out of style.
Where are we going with this, lady?
Well, what if I told you that New Hampshire, a state with very few cows per capita and way fewer cows than Wisconsin, might just rank among the big guys when it comes to ice cream consumption?
No, I don't believe that. Not possible.
Yes, I was curious about the high percentage of consumption of ice cream in our state.
That's listener Erica Rydberg. She wrote in with an only in New Hampshire question based on the premise that New Hampshire eats a lot of ice cream compared to other states.
How'd she go about figuring that out?
I did some Googling to figure this out because I was having some kind of conversation with my boyfriend who's from New York State about general consumption. And I said, I swear New England is one of the highest consumers in general, but by state, I'm pretty sure that New Hampshire is one of the highest. So I think I found an infographic online that shows sort of in scoops how much each of the highest consuming states consumes of ice cream, and New Hampshire came up as one of those top scoop states.
Settling a bet with her boo. Okay. Okay, I like this. Anyways, so this question remains, how did New Hampshire end up such a major ice cream force of a state?
Okay, so naturally, I put our best guys on it. The group's initial theory here at the station was that the scoops themselves are bigger in New Hampshire.
We're going to get ice cream. Do you want to come?
PR car.
Do you want to come get an ice cream?
All right, Sullivan Farms in Tingsboro, Massachusetts. It's very lovely here.
Village Scoop Ice Cream in York, Maine.
I don't think I've ever been in the Granite State.
I went here a lot as a kid. I used to always get anise bears. They had licorice bears.
I'm going to get a small coffee in a sugar cone.
Okay. I'm going to get a small green monster in a cake cone.
Yeah, I'll have a baby burgundy chip, please.
I think we're going to do a mint chocolate chip small in a sugar cone. Yeah.
I will get a black raspberry chip, small, please, in a sugar cone.
First time I came here, ordered a medium, and I got the, like, are you sure lecture.
This is the largest small I've ever seen.
Oh, God. This is thrice as large.
I don't know how you could eat this whole thing before it all melts.
10-centimeter cone, 6-centimeter ice cream, and 6-centimeter width. This is unscientific. For journalism.
Sounds very scientific.
It was extremely scientific, yes, Jimmy.
So does New Hampshire have the biggest scoops?
Okay, so based on the giant sample size of three visits to three ice cream places, no, it does not. Massachusetts actually won that by a landslide.
Sounds like you may need an expert or something.
Yeah, so I called the IDFA.
IDFA.
My name is Audra Cruzy, and I am the communications manager at the International Dairy Foods Association here in Washington, D.C.
There's an International Dairy Foods Association?
Of course, Jimmy.
So the data that we actually have is from last year in 2017. We asked our ice cream maker members, as well as members of the National Retailers Association for Ice Cream, which is Scoop Shop owners, and they told us that the New England region, which includes New Hampshire, actually came in sixth place out of eight U.S. areas in the ranking of most successful ice cream regions.
So it sounds like New Hampshire might not be as ice cream crazy as we thought. So who came out on top?
The Great Lakes region actually took top spot in that. And that makes sense because there's a lot of dairy production going on there.
Great Lakes. Yeah, baby. Wisconsin.
Okay, so that's true. Ice cream manufacturers and scoop shops rank the Great Lakes region as the cream de la cream, if you will, of ice cream eating.
Take that, not Wisconsin.
However, Audra Cruzy wanted to make it clear, ice cream is not a regional thing. It's an American thing.
This has been something that is a historic part of the American culture, especially celebrating in the summer. In 1984, President Ronald Reagan actually recognized this American pastime and designated July as National Ice Cream Month.
National Ice Cream Month? That is the only excuse I need to eat ice cream for every meal.
Yeah. Also, the third Sunday of July is National Ice Cream Day.
Ooh.
And I'm pretty sure that that means you can eat as much ice cream as you want without getting a stomachache.
It's a beautiful thing.
Okay, so back to Erica's question. Even though the International Dairy Foods Association survey got different results, I did find a couple of mentions of New Hampshire being in the top 10 of states that scream for ice cream, including that infographic where Erica got her information, which seems pretty legit. So I'm not ruling it out.
Okay, so are there any theories to maybe why we eat so much ice cream here?
So according to Yelp, we have the second highest number of ice cream shops per capita. That and our warm weather seasons are so short, I think maybe there's a possibility that the whole region just goes ice cream crazy during the summer.
And then there's the fact that we eat so much here at the station.
I think that probably skews the numbers a little, yeah.
Yeah, well, I feel like there's only one thing left to do then.
Okay, what's that?
I mean, we have to reward all this hard work with, you know, more ice cream.
You're a genius, Jimmy.
Thank you.
Let's go.